Emmy Award-winning John Mulaney presents Everybody's in L.A., a special run of six live episodes created by and starring Mulaney that'll stream live on Netflix during the Netflix is a Joke Fest. The comically unconventional show will feature special guests where John Mulaney explores the city of Los Angeles during a week when every funny person is in it. Watch John Mulaney Presents Everybody's in L.A., debuting May 3rd live at 7 p.m. Pacific Time, only on Netflix.
Love the flexibility of working in all sorts of places? Well, working on the go seamlessly requires a strong network like T-Mobile. We have America's largest 5G network, so whether you're on a video call at the park or uploading large files at a coffee shop, we have the 5G speed you need. Whatever takes you on the go, T-Mobile's got you covered. Find out more at T-Mobile.com/network today.
Coverage not available in some areas. See 5G device coverage and access details at T-Mobile.com.
Hey, everybody. Andy Richter here. Welcome back to The Three Questions. I am the host of the show, and today I am talking to Molly Ringwald. You know who Molly Ringwald is, actress, writer, vital part of all of our teenage years. Well, you can see her now on FX and Hulu's Feud, Capote versus the Swans. Molly joined me via Zoom from New York, and here's my conversation with the great and smart and funny and wonderful Molly Ringwald. Hello, Molly. How are you?
Hi. I'm good. I'm a little nervous.
Why?
Well, when I was asked to do the three questions, I thought that they were just like three random questions. And then I read what the questions were. And now I'm like, should I do ayahuasca first or like little psilocybin? It sounds really heavy.
I'm high as a kite right now.
well, good. One of us is.
You know, you start a podcast, you need a gimmick. Mm-hmm. Do you have a podcast
No, I thought about it, but no, I haven't actually pulled the trigger. It seems time consuming.
Yeah, it kind of can be. And it's also like, it's the kind of conversations that I always like to have with people who are willing to have these kind of conversations in between interviews on the Conan couch.
Right.
Like, you know, where are you from? Why do you think you are the way you are? I'm not Barbara Walters trying to make anybody cry or anything, but it is, I've been through probably like a vacation home's worth of therapy in my life. And there's a language to it, and it's a useful language, and it's been really important in my life. And I just, you know, it's kind of like pop therapy, you know,
I'm sort of there for it.
A framework for the conversation. So where are you coming from today?
I'm in New York.
In New York. And you live there now, right?
I do. Yeah. I live in upstate New York.
How long have you been there?
I've been here, off and on since I was, 18, but this trip in upstate New York, with my kids and everything, about 7 or 8 years.
Oh, okay. And what was it about New York? Were you were doing theater and you just kind of...
I've just always been drawn to New York. I mean, I grew up in California. I'm from California, Northern California originally. And I don't know, I just kind of always felt like I wanted to be back east. I wanted to, have like a change of seasons. I wanted to have like a fireplace. And I've just always felt more comfortable back east. And probably it has a lot to do with the fact that, I was a kid actor and Los Angeles has a lot of baggage for me.
That's what I was going to say is New York's main thing that it's not LA.
Yes.
That's the main thing going for it.
And the change of seasons.
Yeah. And the fireplace.
And the cocoa
and the woolly sweaters.
Yeah. And the history. I really like I've always loved to be places that feel like they have, some weight to them. And unfortunately, I feel like, California obviously has history as well, but they've taken away a lot of it. Like all of the stuff that I found really kind of incredible about, Hollywood, they're just you know, getting rid of or have gotten rid of, you know.
Yeah. It's a youth-obsessed place. So it's yes. like you can't have old shit in a youth-obsessed place, you know.
Yeah.
It's a reminder that, you know, things age and that no one wants to believe that here, yeah. I don't think.
Yeah. But I do feel like now that I've been back east for so long, you know, there are things about California that I sort of took for granted, you know, because I grew up in Northern California and, you know, my mom was born in Eureka and my dad was born in Roseville, which is a suburb, you know, in Sacramento, mm-hmm. you know, and I grew up like, you know, around like redwood forests and, you know, and I didn't think that it was like any big deal. And those like incredible mountains, like yeah. there's so much about it that now when I just come back to visit, I'm like, wow, this is amazing. This is kind of extraordinary.
Absolutely. The array of different ecosystems and of natural beauty and, you know, from yeah. desert to coast, it is an amazing place. And then when you put on it, it's like, whatever, it's like the fourth largest economy in the world. You know, it's,
yeah,
it's a pretty, you know, and now, I mean, as this country changes now, because I used to always have kind of an ambivalent sort of relationship with this place, mainly just because LA represents, you know, there's bullshit everywhere, but here it's like enshrined, you yeah. know, there's like, there's,
no, it's you know, next like, level, it's next level.
Yes. and that was always kind of off-putting to me, but now, you know, as the world's changed, I'm kind of like, I'm kind of proud to be a Californian, like, you know.
No, there's definitely good and bad, but I also was very leery about raising my kids around extreme wealth.
Yeah.
You know, like the area that we lived in when we were there, you know, for a while we lived in an area called Rustic Canyon, which is absolutely beautiful, you know,
yeah.
it's by the beach. And I didn't grow up by the beach. So I thought, well, if I have to be in California, I want to be, you know, my kids to like grow up in the surf and, you know, all of that.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And it was really beautiful. But like the crazy, crazy wealth that we were surrounded by, it just sort of like, it made me feel a little uncomfortable. And I just wanted them to kind of grow up in an area that just like seemed a little bit more normal to me
yeah.
and like not, you know, not with that, like where your neighbor is just in like, you know, a huge, huge mansion and, you know, where they,
right.
I just wanted them to grow up in an area that just seemed like yeah. a little bit more grounded.
Away from $150,000 bar mitzvahs.
Yeah. yes.
You know?
yeah.
yeah, no, when I moved out here as a married person with a child from New York City, having lived in New York City for 7 or 8 years at that point, I was like, well, I might as well go to the beach. So I moved to the Palisades and I quickly realized like, I don't like these people. it was definitely a different feel. And all my friends lived in Hollywood or Los Feliz or somewhere else. So
yeah.
to go do things with anybody, there was 45 minutes on, you know, getting there and back. It was like an hour and a half round trip. And I was like, okay, I got to move.
Yeah.
I got to move east.
Yeah.
So.
Where are you from originally?
I'm from Illinois. I'm from outside of Chicago, a small town called Yorkville. So I have a very, you know, I still, Midwesternism can be a wonderful thing, but it's like a different kind of brainwashing of like, you know, where,
yeah.
as I've put it, it's like where you're so humble that you're better than everybody else. You know what I mean? Like
yeah.
your humility makes you a superhero, like,
yeah.
you know, where it's like, I'm nothing and I'm so nothing, I'm better than everybody.
Right.
But there is definitely like the fanciness, what's important, the priorities here are kind of like just the notion of being like in the flow of the show business part of it.
Yeah.
It just is so distasteful to me. Like, I don't want to go to industry parties and I don't want to just hang out with industry people. I mean, you know.
Yeah, me too. I've always wanted to be, and this is something that New York definitely had going for it, is I wanted to meet people who were like, had all different careers, you know,
yeah.
and Hollywood does seem like it's very much like a one, you know, everybody wants to do this one thing and they're either doing it or they want to do it and you're being pitched constantly or you're pitching constantly.
Yes.
You know, and I wanted to go somewhere that had, you know, that like still are artistic because that's generally what I'm drawn to, but like, you know, where they're, but they're, you know, artists and architects and writers and therapists and hairdressers and, animal trainers and scientists. And, you know, I really love to be around all different people. And I wanted my kids to grow up that way too. So,
And even New York City, you know, like if you meet a successful, powerful person in New York City, they might like be the king of window installation. Whereas in LA, if you meet a successful, powerful person, odds are they're in show business in some way. And it gets kind of dull in a way, you know?
Yeah. And can be a little suffocating. But I have to say I do have good friends in LA because I did grow up there. So, you know, it's nice to go back and visit and then feel like I'm coming back to, to an area where I can kind of like exhale a little.
Yeah. No, I don't want to give the wrong impression either. I know some of the most wonderful, lovely people on earth that live here. And I mean, and I have a very nice life here. It's just, you know, show business is, it can be exhausting. It can just be like, it can be soul exhausting. Well, we were talking a little bit right before because you and I think it was the last time I saw you was at a school tour.
Yes, that's right.
It must have been about 18 years ago, I think, because the kid that I was looking for a school for he's 22 now.
Yeah. So we went to that school when my 20-year-old was going into kindergarten, I think.
Yeah.
And we did that school for a couple years, and then we had two more, and then suddenly it was like all about moving somewhere that had a good public school because you know it gets crazy. I mean,
it's ridiculous.
You know, like it's really insane. And you know, we did the thing that everybody does, where you start a college account when they're babies, but. Like the cost of private school is just like, it was a little overwhelming. I grew up in a public school. And I believe public school system and,
Me too. I grew up in I grew up in Yorkville, Illinois. And when I would meet kids from like Chicago suburbs and they would be like, what high school do you go to? And I'm like, Yorkville High School? Like what? And I just wasn't even like familiar with the concept that there were multiple high schools in a town. And I got a good education and I wanted my kids to go to public school, but public schools here, even we lived a couple blocks when my son went to kindergarten, we lived a couple blocks from supposedly the best public school in LA. And there was like one teacher for 32 or 33 kids. And, you know, And no art and no music. All the art and music was parent, volunteer parent stuff.
Yeah.
And so we, you know, my kids have both gone to private schools, and which to me is like I've been paying for somebody to basically get a nice, you know, middle of the road liberal arts college education since 2005.
Yeah.
Every year, you know, and you're right. It's, you know, my finances would be much different if I hadn't poured all that money into my kids' brains.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. It's a little daunting, for sure.
Well, you mentioned it earlier. We'll get back. We'll get into the autobiographical stuff. Mm-hmm. You're from Northern California, mm-hmm. and your mom was a chef and your dad was a jazz pianist. So that's kind of show business, you know?
My mom, well, not
both
really.
Of them, but both of them, you know,
well,
I mean.
My mom didn't become a chef until I left home. She was a stay-at-home mom until basically I left the nest when I was, 18. And my dad was a jazz musician, but like, you know, he was a jazz musician in a small kind of, jazz community in Sacramento. Like he didn't tour. He didn't, you know, he was kind of like a big fish in a little pond.
Uh-huh. And he made a living playing jazz in Sacramento?
Yeah, but I mean, he made a living like basically doing everything. Like he was like he did piano bar at night, and you know, my dad was blind, so
oh wow,
you know, he didn't read music. But he was, yeah, he was a working musician, and that's how he supported our family. And then I started acting professionally when I was. My first professional job was at 10. I was in the first West Coast production of Annie, which is how I got started. And then kind of went from that to television and then that to movies. And then once I did that, then our family lived both from my dad's salary and through my salary, because there was no way not to, you know, if my,
right.
Sometimes my mom would come with me on film shoots, and then sometimes my dad would. And if my dad was, then, you know, he obviously couldn't, you know, work.
Make money. Yeah.
Yeah. So yeah, that was my upbringing.
How did you start doing, show business? How did you start acting?
Well, all of it, me, I have a brother and a sister, and, you know, we all did acting, and, you know, dance and singing, you know, as like, kind of like an extracurricular activity. Mm-hmm. And, you know, along with like swimming and, you know, whatever else.
Yeah. Just one of many kid activities.
Yeah. It was one of many activities. But I was the only one that was really drawn to music. And so I used to perform with my dad. You know, since I was like 3 years old,
and like sing with them.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh my gosh. I bet that
I was like the world's youngest jazz singer. Like that was my kind of shticky shtick. But it was really something I loved to do. It was like my dad passed away a couple years ago, but like we were really, had a great relationship and were really close. And, so I kind of got to the acting thing through the music, I would say. Like when I was really little, I thought that that was kind of where my focus was going to be, in music. And then when I got older and I did my first movie when I was 13 years old, then I kind of switched to the acting and filmmaking, and that's like kind of all I wanted to do. But yeah, the music thing was basically, you know, at that time, anybody who could sing or dance wanted to be an Annie. That was kind of like mm-hmm. the thing. And so, and I, like every other kid at the time, I was listening to the, you know, the album nonstop. And so when it was casting on the West Coast, somebody mentioned to my dad, like, oh, you know, she should really try out for this. And I did, and I got it. And so our family ended up moving from Sacramento to Los Angeles. And then at the time, both me and my sister and brother were acting. And then eventually I was the only one who continued.
Looking for some amazing TV to stream? Indulge yourself with the hits on Hulu you can't miss. Dive in with Barney, Ted, Robin, and the gang on How I Met Your Mother. All 9 seasons are now streaming on Hulu. Then you can move to Modern Family, Schitt's Creek, and My Wife and Kids. We're talking every episode and every season of these shows. We're talking huge hits, streaming on Hulu whenever you're in the mood. Now we're talking.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy, so go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
Love the flexibility of working in all sorts of places? Well, working on the go seamlessly requires a strong network like T-Mobile. We have America's largest 5G network, so whether you're on a video call at the park or uploading large files at a coffee shop, we have the 5G speed you need. Whatever takes you on the go, T-Mobile's got you covered. Find out more at T-Mobile.com/network today.
Coverage not available in some areas. See 5G device coverage and access details at T-Mobile.com.
Can't you tell my love's a crow?
Is it weird to have your family uproot itself for the employment of a child? you know, like, can you imagine doing that? You know,
No, but I mean, I was told at the time that it was like, it wasn't just me, it was my dad as well. Like, it was opportunities for, you know, his work and what he did.
Yeah.
I think probably it was mostly me, but I remember, I mean, I was pretty young, so I wasn't really, you know, I remember there was some talk about we were either going to move to Los Angeles or to Florida. And I think it was because my dad had some kind of a job opportunity in Florida. But we ended up moving to LA, which was, you know, much closer to Sacramento. But yeah, I mean, it wasn't like somebody asked me necessarily. It was just kind of like, it was happening, but it was something I think I was excited about because it meant that I was going to do this play that I really wanted to do. And, you know, but yeah, it was kind of a decision that was made that I wasn't really necessarily privy to.
Yeah. Was it good? I mean, was it good for your dad too? Or did he end up working more and in a more sort of satisfying way?
I don't know. I mean, as soon as I left home, my parents moved back up north. So I don't think, I think they really hated LA, like really hated it, ended up hating. I mean, again, they had friends there and my dad did have a band and he also, you know, had a radio show and like he did stuff, but I don't think that they ever felt like it was their home. But, you know, I also really didn't feel like it was my home either. I don't think any of us did, really. But it was definitely, I think, better for my career to live in Los Angeles.
Does that give you the ability to kind of live anywhere? You know, when at a certain, at such a young age, your residence becomes a place that, you know, you don't really feel a part of. So, therefore, you're free from an attachment to a geography.
I mean, I felt like, well, once I, you know, had the career, I felt like I had to live there, you know, and I got a house and, you know, had like a certain lifestyle and, you know, but I also really felt like I didn't really want to be there. I didn't really feel like a connection to it other than like a career connection. And I felt like a little trapped and like, I think definitely suffocated and it wasn't like really artistically satisfying to me. But I also felt like, you know, I wanted to know more of the world than just that, you know, that Hollywood bubble.
Yeah.
And it really is a bubble. I mean,
yeah.
I mean, I guess everywhere is a bubble of sorts. You know, I'm like living in a different bubble now, but I prefer this bubble.
Yeah.
You know, but I, after I was in LA, I think, you know, in my early 20s, I moved to Paris just because I wanted to like live somewhere outside of, you know, Hollywood and someplace that, you know, when you live in Hollywood, you definitely get this feeling like, oh my God, this is the most important place on earth. This is where everything's happening, you know, and then you go somewhere else and you're like, oh, actually this is the center of the world.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
you know, this is where everything's happening because you're moving into like a different bubble. And it was just really interesting to me to be able to sort of basically live somewhere where at the time I wasn't really famous. I mean, now the films that I did, the John Hughes films have kind of like reached cult status everywhere. But at the time, like, you know, I wasn't really immediately recognizable. And that was really important for me to have like some part. I did it in my 20s rather than my teens. But at least I did it. I went somewhere where I wasn't famous. And that was really, really great.
When you started really working and you started to become famous, I mean, what was that like? When was there an age at which you started to feel like, I mean, not that you would feel it in this way, but like where you're like aware of being famous all of a sudden? And what was that like as a, you know, a kid, as a teen? Because I mean, being a teen is like being a vapor. Like you're not, you know, you're not gelled yet. You know, who you are is still very much in flux. And I can only imagine the pressure of, you know, being recognized, you know, because I've had to explain when I first got on television. I once had to explain to my mother when we were in a store and she said, everyone's looking at you. And I said, Mom, think about that. everyone was looking at me. Yeah, I know how, but I know why. I understand the reason, but it still feels like, what, you know, like my, you know, sort of like spiritual fly is open constantly, you know?
Yeah. No, it was definitely different and strange. It kind of started out a little bit gradually for me because, you know, I feel like Annie was like one little taste of notoriety and fame. But mm-hmm. I couldn't really be recognized from that unless I was like with the Annie Orphans with my like satin Annie jacket on, you know, and like, where are the Annie Orphans?
Yeah. Here comes that orphan gang.
Yeah. So that was like a little taste of it. And then I immediately got on these Norman Lear shows, you know, Different Strokes and then Facts of Life, which I did for a year. And that was like another level because that was television. I was still in like fifth or sixth grade when I did that. I kind of went right from Annie into Facts of Life. And mostly it was just really hard at school because I was still going to public school at the time. And if you do anything that's like a little out of the norm, it's just basically, you know, fodder for bullies, you know?
Yeah,
it's like it was really hard. I really did have like a lot of bullies in sixth grade. And then seventh grade was a little better when I kind of went for a pretty long period of time before I did my first movie. I was just kind of like auditioning for stuff. And then the John Hughes movies like exploded. And then I was kind of like, I went from being sort of like a normal kid again to being like the most popular teenager in the world.
And sort of like an icon, like the icon of teenageism, you know, of teenagerness, you know.
Yeah. And then that was weird. And then like once that happened, I think, you know, when I look back on it, I think I just kind of like went into this sort of like, you know, I sort of like disassociated a little bit, you know, it was kind of and sort of like became just hyper aware of being watched and looked at and it was not comfortable for me. It was definitely like not expected. It wasn't something that I was working towards something, you know, I knew that this was what I wanted to do with my life, but I didn't realize that it was going to happen like so suddenly. I thought I was just going to be sort of like gradually doing this thing. And this, I just thought it was going to be a more gradual thing. And it wasn't, it was like, it was really full on.
What age is it? Is when this, you know, when the faucet is turned all the way on?
I would say, well, I was 15 years old when I did 16 Candles, and then I was 16 years old when I did Breakfast Club, and then I was 18 years old when I did Pretty in Pink. And so I would say it was really probably after the release of the Breakfast Club, which was like a huge hit, and then Pretty in Pink, which was even like a bigger hit. So it was kind of like, I guess it would have been like around age 17. And then I was on the cover of Time when I was like 18. Mm-hmm. And so that was kind of when everything, you know, was really like sort of exploded and everything kind of like gets like a little foggy. And then all of my bullies wanted to be my best friend, of course, because I suddenly was like, you know, really popular.
Right.
Teenager.
Buffers. Yeah. it's like, just having been through the Christmas season because I have a 22-year-old, an 18-year-old, and now a 3.5-year-old. And so I'm kind of, to me, I'm looking at it like pre-grandparent. Like I'm reliving all these like little kid things, but like, you know, having heard Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer just recently 8,000 times, I'm like, what a shitty story. Like, only when you're useful from the big man are you now popular. And
Rudolph was totally bullied.
Yeah.
You know.
What did your parents, what was their feeling about this time when you start to feel so over-scrutinized? Is there anything that they could do or were doing to sort of help you through it?
I think that they were you know, both excited, you know, but I think, you know, they were worried. They were, you know, my parents were pretty protective. I mean, I did have parents that, like, you know, definitely cared about me, and like, they definitely, like, didn't see me as a meal ticket. That was, you know, not what they were about.
Yeah.
I think, you know, I can't really say if they necessarily expected it. Like, when I talk to my mom now, she says, like, if she had to do it over again, she wouldn't have let me act as a child.
Wow.
Because I feel like they saw how psychologically difficult it was for me. And also, like, they didn't really know about show business. Like, they were, you know, what my dad did in, you know, as a musician, it was really very small town. It wasn't like, you know, Hollywood is like a business.
Yeah.
And I think that they were, yeah, they didn't really know about it. And, you yeah. know, so, like, I kind of had to face that with my kids. My elder daughter is an actress now, but she's 20, but I wouldn't let her be a child actress. And it was a real bone of contention between us, because she said, you know, well, why you got to do it? And I'm like, well, yeah, but
that's why.
But my mom says if she had to do it over yeah. again, she would have waited. And, you know, yeah, it was definitely difficult. But I mean, I don't want to do like a whole boo-hoo, poor me.
Yeah, no, like, I understand.
I was also really fortunate, and I had, yeah. you know, I had a lot of great opportunities. I just think that it's something it's a really big decision, and I don't know if kids really should be making those kinds of decisions.
Yeah. And I understand you don't want to seem self-pitying, but, you know, but then the other hand, oh, it was all fantastic and a dream come true is as equally, like, overcooked of an yeah. opinion or of a take on the whole situation, because it is super complicated, and it is, you know, not being able to go around somewhere and just enjoy the anonymity that a 16, 17 year old is craving, you know, like, is yeah. really almost like needs for proper development. It's yeah. gotta be, you know.
And the problem is I feel like no kid is really getting that now because of the internet.
Yeah.
You know, I didn't have to deal with, you know, TikToks and, like, social media and all of that stuff. And it was difficult. It was difficult with the paparazzi. It was difficult with, you know, magazines, because, you know, Hollywood is all about, like, building people up and tearing them down, and, you know.
Yeah.
And I did deal with that, and that was really hard. But now when I think about kids are sort of giving their anonymity away when they're really, really
yeah.
young.
Yeah. And with no interlocutor either. It's just yeah. like them, a computer screen, and then all of a sudden, you know, for one weird reason or another, there's 12 million people knowing who they are.
Yeah.
What do you think was the most difficult aspect of it when you were a kid? Was it, like, is it hard to trust people? Is it that you become, you know, claustrophobic not claustrophobic, but the opposite, you know, like, you know, where you're
or there's no
agoraphobic. Yeah.
I feel like the hardest thing for me was, yeah, not feeling like, it felt very lonely, because my experience was very different from other kids that were my age. You know, I felt like I was living this adult life in this, like, nice, fancy house, you know, that was an investment, because that's what you did when you made money. You got a house,
yeah,
you know.
Yeah, yeah.
But, like, other kids my age, like, they were, you know, living with roommates, or, you know, going to college, or, you know, like, I just felt like I kind of had one foot in this world and another foot in another world, and I didn't quite belong anywhere.
Yeah.
And it was also hard. Like, I never wanted, you know, my parents were the ones that made decisions about my career when I was a teenager. And then as soon as I turned 18, I was like, no, I want to do everything myself, because I really wanted to have parents that were just parents that yeah. were not connected to my career. And I think for me, that was the right thing to do.
I absolutely like that. The prescience of that is amazing, really, you know, like get your parents out of your business as yeah. soon as possible and just yeah. let them be your parents.
Yeah. And I think that that was the right thing. And, but I think it was hard for them, you know, to suddenly, you know, have me, you know, it was hard.
Yeah.
You know, and I think, but it was ultimately good. I mean, I have a good relationship with my parents and, you know, and I'm glad that I had that experience. I did try to yeah. normalize things as much as I could. But, you know, it's hard to grow up in the public eye, you know?
Yeah.
It's like, it's, and like I said, I can't imagine doing it now. Like,
yeah.
if the internet existed when I was becoming famous, I don't know if I would have decided to continue with it.
Yeah.
Because to have that sort of level of fame in the internet age, like, I just, it's not for me.
As an actor myself, I wonder about like how your technique develops through this being so young. I mean, are you going to acting classes at this time or is it really kind of on the job training where you're just kind of learning to do it as you do it?
I think it's both. I did do some classes at a place that was called the Young Actor Space that was just mm-hmm. kind of starting. Diane Harden, who was the wife of Jerry Harden, who I worked with, and the mother of Melora Harden, mm-hmm. from The Office. She was just starting an actor studio that was specifically geared towards young actors, hence the Young Actor Space.
Uh-huh.
And so I was in like that original class when I was like 13, 14 years old after I did my first movie. And I really enjoyed it. It was a great experience to be around, you know, actors who were, you know, my age or, you know, around my age. And it was teaching some variation of the method. You know, I learned how to improvise. I learned how to do scene work. But that was the only acting class that I took. After that, everything was pretty much on the job training. And I yeah. worked with a lot of great people. I mean, I worked, my first movie was, you know, Paul Mazursky movie and working with Jenna Rollins and John Cassavetes and Raul
yeah,
Julia
yeah.
and like... Over the years, I was lucky enough to like work with some really great people. So
yeah,
I did kind of learn on the job, I'd say.
You know, it can be such a vulnerable thing because, you know, it's just you and your face and your words and your emotions. And I mean, as you're doing it, where are you drawing the source of sort of strength and self-position to be able to go ahead and, you know, because when they say you're going to be number one on the call sheet, you're going to be the star of this movie, you know, that's a lot of pressure for a 30-year-old.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, where are you finding that kind of, or are you just not thinking about it? Are you just kind of rolling with it?
I wasn't really thinking that much about number one on the call sheet.
I just say that because that's my thing. That's how
yeah,
I, you know.
Yeah, no, that, I feel like that's kind of like become like a big thing. Like when people talk about like, oh, number one in the call sheet, like that's,
yeah, yeah.
You know, I did like for me, I remember there was like, you know, do you have your name above title or not? That was a big thing, you know, like
mm-hmm.
do you, yeah, it was something, but I don't know. I was really kind of at the time I was excited about the work that I was doing. And I did feel like, especially when I was working with John Hughes, like I loved what I was doing and I loved working with him, even though he wasn't the easiest guy in the whole world. But I did feel like I was excited by the work. And so it felt kind of effortless mm-hmm. in a way. Yeah, the work was great. It was everything other than the work that
yeah.
I had trouble with.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah, yeah.
PR and the stories and the sort of following somebody else's narrative, you know? Like that is the one thing that I do like about having social media now is that I can speak for myself now.
Yeah.
And yeah, journalists are still going to have their narrative, but I can kind of write my own narrative, which is also something that's been interesting to me about writing. writing books, it is really hard to follow somebody else's narrative when you're a young, well, at any age, but especially as you're figuring out who you are.
Yeah. When you move to Paris, at what age is this that when you move?
I moved to Paris when I was 24.
24?
Yeah.
And are you thinking like I'm leaving Hollywood behind kind of, or is this just sort of like I'm going to try this for a while?
No, I went there on a film and then I wasn't thinking at all that I was leaving Hollywood behind. I went there on a movie and I had enrolled it in, USC. I did my, SATs late, but I was like, oh, well, I guess I should go to college. I guess that's something I should do. 'Cause I wasn't really getting any, film scripts that I really liked. I turned down a couple that maybe I shouldn't have turned down, but I just wasn't really drawn to anything. I also felt like everybody really once you do something, once you do something in Hollywood and you're successful at that, that's just what everyone wants you to do.
Yeah.
And they think that you can't do anything else.
Yeah.
And then if you're lucky enough to squeak by and do something else that's successful, then that's what they want you to do. It's like, and I felt like I didn't want to do any more teen movies at the time. I probably, looking back on it, I probably should have done a couple more just because, because I was really young. But I didn't relate to that teen world because my world had completely changed. And I was really very much like living in this adult world. And so for whatever reason, nothing really spoke to me. So I decided to go to Paris on this film and then I would come back and go to college. And I figured I would just do that. And then I ended up just falling in love with Paris and kind of more than anything, falling in love with this feeling that I had. And so I decided to chase that. And then I just stayed in Paris.
How long were you there?
I mean, on and off. I'm actually writing a memoir right now about my time in Paris. It was like all said and done. It was about 10 years.
Oh, wow.
It was about 5 where it was my sole residence. But mm-hmm. I mean, I would continue to come back and it wasn't like I didn't retire or anything. I kept doing stuff, but definitely my career was put on the back burner.
You weren't pushing as like, get me parts, get me this. Yeah. Yeah.
No, unless like I needed like new drapes and then I would go, I need new drapes.
The old story.
So I'll go,
Yeah. Yeah.
I really focused on kind of doing France for a while and really becoming bilingual and kind of traveling and doing and writing also. I really started to write.
Did you enjoy some, more anonymity there? Was that part of what you liked? Or were you
Definitely.
Very well, I mean, at that point, I mean, were John Hughes movies big in, when you moved there, was it like?
No, they weren't. They have now, attained a kind of cult status. But at the time, if I was recognized, it was usually by a tourist. I was not recognized by, the general public. I also dyed my hair dark brown too. So for a while I was kind of just tooling around with dark brown hair and pretending like I was French. And it was really fun. It was really great. I didn't realize that I could have, told USC that, I could have deferred it and gone, but instead I just kind of like, decided not to do that and decided to just kind of, go to French class and read a lot and kind of self-educate myself.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches, but there's only one McCrispy. So go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
Love the flexibility of working in all sorts of places? Well, working on the go seamlessly requires a strong network like T-Mobile. We have America's largest 5G network, so whether you're on a video call at the park or uploading large files at a coffee shop, we have the 5G speed you need. Whatever takes you on the go, T-Mobile's got you covered. Find out more at T-Mobile.com/network today.
Coverage not available in some areas. See 5G device coverage and access details at T-Mobile.com.
Can't you tell my love's a crow?
Do you have any regrets about not going to college?
I try not to have regrets in my life because I don't really feel like they serve me, mm-hmm. you know, unless you can like go back and do, you know, I don't know. Here's what I really regret. No, I don't regret going to USC because I don't think that I really wanted to do that. I think I was just doing that because I felt like I should. The one thing I regret is I met Toni Morrison, who was one of my favorite writers, and I went to this Time magazine party like in the late 90s. I was visiting New York, and it was a party for everyone who, at that time, it was before they did like the 100 thing that they're doing now. It was just, it was a party for, I think it was like in 99 or something, for everyone who had ever been on the cover of Time was invited to go, except for three people. We'll get back to that. But Toni Morrison was there, and I was such a huge fan of hers. And she was also born on my birthday, or I was born on her birthday. And I talked to her, and she invited me. She was teaching at Princeton at the time, and she invited me to audit her class. She's like, come on, you know, because I told her that I was going to go to USC and that I didn't end up going. She said, come audit my class at Princeton. And I didn't go, and I do regret that.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
That would have been amazing. But I think I was like flying back to Paris or something like that. But I do have regrets that I didn't follow up on that.
That's a good regret.
Yeah. That's
pretty,
a good one. As regrets
pretty high
go.
Class regret. Yeah.
That's a grade A regret. Yeah.
Well, when you're done with Paris, do you come back to LA? Do you come back to New York? And what motivates that change? Is it just, do you just kind of, like, are there times when it's time for you to change the scenery and move somewhere else?
Yeah, I think so. I think, I was involved with somebody there and having kind of like a hard time leaving that relationship.
Yeah.
So at a certain point, I decided to get an apartment in New York and kind of commute and go back and forth between New York and LA. I mean, not LA, New York and Paris. So I think that was kind of like a first step in like a years long process to break up. But I think I stayed in France and I stayed in that relationship longer than I should have because I loved France so much. I loved Paris. I loved that feeling of being there. So I kind of drew out this long relationship. And I think every time I've moved somewhere, it's because something in my gut is just telling me that this is the thing to do, that this is what I need to do. And I realized that I still wanted to act. Like I really still wanted to, and it was something that I really had to ask myself again as an adult, because I had started when I was so young, I had to sort of like say, okay, is this something that you still want to do?
Yeah.
And I guess, you know, it was, but I knew that I wanted to do other stuff too. I knew that I wanted to write and I know that I want to direct and, but I knew that I couldn't do that in the way that I wanted to in France, but I had to do it in the US. So yeah, that's kind of when I moved back from Paris, I moved to New York.
And you started doing Broadway stuff then at that point, right?
Yeah. Yeah. I started doing Broadway. I did, you know, I came back to singing, for a while and I did Cabaret and I did Tick Tick Boom and I did Enchanted April. And then I met the person who I married, the husband of my three kids, when I was,
he's the father of your three kids, by the way.
What did I say?
The husband of your three kids.
Oh, the husband. Oh, that's interesting. Interesting. Yes. Yes, the father.
Yes, right.
The father of my three children. We met when I was sort of starting my 30s. And we had our first child in New York, actually, when I was finishing up Cabaret. And then we moved to L.A. And he ended up going to business school. And I ended up doing a series in L.A. And then we had two more kids. and then moved back here.
Was motherhood something you always knew was in store for you?
Always. Yeah. It was something that I wanted to be. Like, there was just no question that I was going to be a mother. I was one of those, like, I played with dolls. I just, like, since kindergarten, I can remember, like, wanting to be a mother. Which was very different than my husband. Like, he did not, he's an incredible father, but it wasn't something that he, like, he didn't have that constant drumbeat telling him that he had to reproduce. But I did. I mean, I was like, and it became like absolutely deafening. Like, right around the time when I met my husband, it was like, must have children, must have children. And it was like, yeah, it was almost like a bone of not a bone of contention, but it was like it was a little bit of a struggle because
and
I mean
he had
he's
to
also,
overcome his yeah
yeah he's younger than me too. He's 7 years younger than me, so like we were kind of meeting in like different parts of our different moments in our life, and you know he ended up having kids a lot younger than he thought he was going to.
Well, he had three, so you know he obviously. Yeah. Once he got a taste, he knew it was for him. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. But they were also like, we had kids 6 years apart. And I think our plan was always just to have like, you know, two. Yeah. But it ended up being three because we have 14-year-old twins.
Yeah.
But yeah, I love being a parent. But I think that he's a little bit, I would say, he's a little bit more nurturing than I am.
Oh, really?
Like, I feel like he excels in a way that neither one of us knew. I mean, I knew that he was going to be a good father, which is kind of like, I feel like instinctively, I was like,
yeah,
you, you're going to be a good father.
Right, right, right.
I don't think he knew he was going to be a great father. And I don't think that I ever imagined that I was going to be anything but like an excellent mother. And I find that it comes much more naturally to him than to me, which is funny. I certainly don't think I'm a bad parent, but I think that he is an excellent parent.
I was going to ask, because it's just something that I ask what do you think is the best part of your mothering and what is the part of your mothering that you feel like you fall short on?
I think the best part of my mothering is that I love them and that I care and that I'm honest, like really honest, not honest in a cruel way, but like they always know that I won't bullshit them and that I'll tell them the truth. And that if I say something to them, if I give them a compliment, let's say, which I do try to do, but if I like, it's for real and I really mean it.
Yeah, yeah.
I think that he is better at, he's just like more nurturing. And he's also better at doing things that he doesn't necessarily want to do because they want to do it.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know. We have different styles of parenting. But he's definitely more like, you know, he'll just do everything. He'll make three different meals for three different kids.
Oh, wow.
And I'm like, you should be lucky that you have any food at all. I'm much tougher, but like, I feel like a lot of that just has to do with, you know, the way that I was raised, like the way that we were raised was different. He's first generation American with two Greek parents, and the Greeks super nurturing and loving and physically affectionate.
Especially with boys, little boys in Greek families. Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
I have a lot of Greek friends and, you know, knew a lot of Greek, had a lot of Greek friends and was familiar with their family dynamic. And little Greek boys are princes, you know.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So we definitely, I just think it's so interesting when you have, when you kind of like know something about yourself, like I knew forever that I wanted to be a mother and I feel like these kids would not exist if it weren't for that thing in my mind that was like, must have these children. Like I was just so driven. I never really realized that I don't know. I really had to like kind of realize that there wasn't something that I necessarily excelled at. Like it was just, I was sort of like blown away by how great Ponyo, my husband, is as a father, and just kind of like learn that I'm still learning as a mother. Yeah. I mean, now I'm kind of like making myself out to be a terrible mother, and I definitely don't think that
I don't think you are.
That I
don't think you are. I don't think you are at all. No. I think, you know, you're being honest. Like you said, the strength that you have with your kids is being honest, and you're being honest here, you know?
Yeah. And I also try to let them know that they can talk to me about anything. And I feel like that's another strength that I have as a mom, is that I feel like my kids really do think that they can talk to me about anything, and they do.
Yeah.
And I think that they know that I'm going to love them no matter what. And I think that is a strength.
Well, thank you for answering that. Cause I know, you know, it's kind of a little invasive question. So, we've been talking here a while now. I want to get to, you got to get to the plugs, you know, because otherwise the publicist will be mad.
Oh,
you are co-starring in Feud, Capote versus the Swans, with this cast, Naomi Watts, Diane Lane, Chloe Sevigny, Calista Flockhart, and Demi Moore on FX January 1st, and it'll stream on Hulu as well. What is Capote versus the Swans?
Well, it's Ryan Murphy's the second season of Feud.
Oh, right.
Which is like a famous feud. And this one is the feud of Truman Capote versus all of these, you know, they're saying the original housewives.
Were these muses.
High society. Yeah. The muses. And he called them the swan and the swans, and then kind of just fucked them over by writing this book. You know, The Coat Basque. I was actually a story, and then it was supposed to be a book called Answered Prayers, which never materialized. But they're on the poster. I'm the swan, but in real life, I play Joanne Carson, who was the ex-wife of Johnny Carson, and was basically the last person that was there for him. Like he died in her arms, or in the show, he dies in her arms. He definitely died in her house. But I'm kind of like the last one standing. I was the only one that was kind of like there for him at the end.
Yeah. Who's playing Capote?
It is an incredible cast. Tom Hollander, who is just extraordinary as Truman. And Joe Mantello is also in it. And Jessica Lange plays Truman's mom.
Yeah.
It is a pretty extraordinary cast.
How is it on a Ryan Murphy set? Because some of his things are just so almost, you know, on bizarre. I mean, it's his stuff is as bizarre as big time TV gets sometimes.
Oh yeah. Well, it was like, I mean, amazing. One of the most amazing things about working with Ryan is the cast. I mean, you know, I did Dahmer for him, and the person that I had all my scenes with was Richard Jenkins, because we were playing husband and wife. I played Dahmer's stepmother. But like Richard Jenkins, incredible actor. All my scenes in this one are with Tom Hollander, another amazing actor. So I think that's one of the most exciting things about working with Ryan is just the level of his casting. And Gus Van Zandt is directing. And and also just the fact that he's doing these parts for, you know, women. Like I am now like a woman of a certain age. And I'm incredibly grateful to Ryan that he makes these projects. Like he loves really strong women.
Yeah. Oh yeah, absolutely. I mean, well, the first feud, you know, the first feud being about Bette Davis and Joan Crawford, that was that was a lot of fun, that one.
Yeah.
Well, what do you think, you know, what do you feel like is kind of, you know, if somebody asks you for advice, what do you tell them? You know, kind of, you know, if they're like, well, you know, what should I do with myself? What should I do with my time? What would be your answer to that question?
I think do something that you love.
Yeah.
You know, realistically, yes, people have to make money too, but I feel like if you can, I mean, the best is obviously if you can make money from doing something that you love, that's like you hit the jackpot.
Yeah, yeah.
But otherwise, like, don't say that you're going to do that thing that you love another time. Like, try to squeeze in time to do something that's incredibly important, that nourishes your soul.
Yeah.
And because I think that anytime anybody decides not to do that and just do something because they think that their parents want them to do it or somebody else, like anytime you're doing something just for someone else, I think it's just like a recipe for disaster.
Yeah.
And you should do things that nourish your soul and do something, whether it's, you know, creating art or whether it's, you know, making the world a better place or like doing something for, you know, nonprofit or, you know, do something that feeds your soul.
Well, that's good advice. I agree. I mean, I wouldn't tell you if I didn't, because it's so close to the end. I don't want to start a fight now. Feud, Capote versus the Swans, is premiering January 31st. You also have some really wonderful, you are a wonderful writer. I just want to, you know.
Thank you.
I try to avoid the whole just blowing smoke up people in this podcast, but you truly are a wonderful writer, and you have two books, Getting the Pretty Back, Friendship, Family, and Finding the Perfect Lipstick, which is, it's been out a while now.
Yeah, that's been out a while.
And When It Happens to You, a Novel in Stories.
Is a novel that I wrote, Novel and Stories. And also I have two translations that I did, one called Lie With Me by Philippe Besson, and another one, My Cousin Maria Schneider, written by Vanessa Schneider. And both of those are out right now.
And you're working on a new one, I hear.
And I'm working on a memoir about my time in Paris called The Paris Years, and that should be out. Yeah, I'm still writing it, so it'll be out in a while.
Great. Well, thank you so much, Molly. And
thank you.
And I hope our paths cross soon. And
same.
It's been great talking to you. And I appreciate all of you out there listening. And I'll be back next week with more of The Three Questions.
The Three Questions with Andy Richter is a Team Coco production. It is produced by Sean Doherty and engineered by Rich Garcia. Additional engineering support by Eduardo Perez and Joanna Samuel. Executive produced by Nick Liao, Adam Sachs, and Jeff Ross. Talent booking by Paula Davis, Gina Batista, with assistance from Maddie Ogden. Research by Alyssa Grawl. Don't forget to rate and review and subscribe to The Three Questions with Andy Richter wherever you get your podcasts. And do you have a favorite question you always like to ask people? Let us know in the review section.
Can't you tell my love's growing? Can't you feel it? Ain't it showing? Oh, you must be a knowing. I've got a big, big love.
This has been a Team Coco production.
Life is a highway. And on it, there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy. So go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
Love the flexibility of working in all sorts of places? Well, working on the go seamlessly requires a strong network like T-Mobile. We have America's largest 5G network, so whether you're on a video call at the park or uploading large files at a coffee shop, we have the 5G speed you need. Whatever takes you on the go, T-Mobile's got you covered. Find out more at T-Mobile.com/network today.
Coverage not available in some areas. See 5G device coverage and access details at T-Mobile.com.